stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with Andrei Maleev-Babel, who is not only a teacher at the FSU Conservatory for Actor Training, but also directs the second-year students in one of their productions. Today, we are talking not only about Andrei's extraordinary story, but his direction of Candida, which is currently playing at the Cook Theater. This is an extraordinary story, so hang on. Here come the show.
Inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
Welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being who you really are so you can live the life you were meant to live. And if you've been listening to the show, you know that I talk about that at the beginning of my shows before I do the other thing I do in my show, which is play interviews with people who make their living or their life with an art. Because when you listen to them, you know what it sounds like to be who you really are. Today, I'm playing an interview with Andrei Maleev-Babel, who began his life in Russia and is now teaching at what is one of the 10 best actor training schools in the United States. Andrei's story is, I think, remarkable. And in addition to his story, he's talking about the production of Candida, which he directed for the second-year students and which is currently playing at the Cook Theater. This is a very long interview, and I wanted to play as much of it as I possibly could, so I'm not going to talk anymore. I'm simply going to introduce Andrei Maleev-Babel.
I am here with Andrei Maleev-Babel in his office in the Oslo building to talk to him about the play he is directing. So let me explain to you that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Clearly you are doing that. And I always ask the same question, and that is, how did the art capture you? How did it happen? How did it start? How did it get you?
But just the atmosphere in which I grew up was very artistic.
Mm-hmm.
because my grandfather was a writer, my grandmother was working, getting his works published, and or writing memoirs about him. There were lots of kind of friends in the at the house constantly who were either writers or actors or directors or artists. My mother was an architect. So the atmosphere, as you see, was very artistic. And
where did you grow up?
In Moscow. Uh-huh. In Moscow, and in Russia's capital, at that point the capital of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that this is how it all started. So there are lots of inspiration. I was taken to concerts, musical theater, you know, drama theater.
So the whole idea of being a creative and artistic person, I mean, it's almost as though one wouldn't have come out of that soup as something else?
Probably not. Probably not. I mean, literature would have been another avenue, perhaps, but now I'm writing, but you see, I'm writing about theater, or I'm writing adaptations of plays.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm doing different things. I studied music, and I still continue working with music, but it's music for the theater.
Uh-huh.
If I write, it's about the theater, or for the theater. I act, direct, I teach. So you see, I do
it's
many
all the
things,
theater, though.
Yes, but they're all dedicated to the theater.
Well, okay, so how did that happen, the love affair with the theater?
It's difficult to say, but, you know, it started very early because, as all of the kind of children who grow up to be actors, I was doing some kind of domestic performances at a very early age, puppet theater, which is also very traditional. I was also directing because there were these performances that usually were connected with birthday parties. And guests would come, and inspired by one family tradition that I observe, I would write a play, which was usually a parody, a burlesque on some famous fairy tale or something. I would write music for it. I would like songs, would write songs for it. And I would direct the guests, who were all obviously adults, and
yeah.
I was a little kid. I would direct them in this performance.
How old were you when you started doing this?
Oh, I don't know. Probably we are talking about 12 years old,
uh-huh.
something like that.
Yeah.
So I would direct them, and then they would basically perform this at the end of the party.
They would indulge you.
They would absolutely indulge me, and for quite a while, actually, because of how early I started directing,
mm-hmm.
I was working with actors who were sometimes significantly older than I was.
Yes, but you had the permission, the encouragement, I don't know what the word is, that it wasn't a stretch, it wasn't, that it was just, yes, well, of course, he can do this.
I was surprised, but yes, I did get that permission, and
yeah.
nobody ever really doubted me because of my age.
Right. Nobody said, who do you think you are, or what do you think you're
no,
doing?
No, for some reason people kind of went along.
Yeah.
Probably long before I knew what I was really doing.
I'm sure that's right.
Yeah, they kind of went along. Yes,
I'm sure that's so. Right. And that is such an incredible gift to someone who's, whatever it is you're going to do, if people start right off telling you that you have the right to do it, that you're good at it, that you know, I mean, at the beginning, no one ever really is, so, but to get that right off the bat,
yeah.
There's no struggle attached.
Yeah, to get that acceptance.
Yes.
I wouldn't say that I had to seriously fight for it, because when I entered theater school in Moscow, I entered on the directing track, and I was 19. And all of my fellow students were in their 30s or even 40s, because the idea was in Russia, at least the idea is that if you are training to be a director, you need to have had some professional experience and certainly have certain knowledge of life.
Oh my God. So how did you...
I don't know. I was the only probably person in the history of that school, at least, you know, as far as I'm aware, who was accepted onto the directing track at that age.
And did you know at the time how unusual that was?
Yes, I did. I was trying to actually enter on a more typical kind of, for my age, acting track.
Right, so that you could get the acting and the life
of
behind
course,
you.
Of course, and I
right.
would enjoy it. And
yes.
I continued acting and I act still,
mm-hmm.
right? But that's not what wasn't the emphasis of my training. And thankfully, the Russian idea of training directors is that they have to go through the entire acting program.
Yes.
And then on top of it, they have to learn to direct, because, you know, you're ending up working with actors, you might as well know how actors
what
work.
What a concept.
What a concept, exactly.
So were you doing them at the same time?
It was the program for directors, but acting classes were just part of the curriculum.
Yeah,
in addition to directing, the history of theater, the history of art, and other subjects.
You loved them all.
Especially the, you know, studying the communist science, because we're talking about the 1980s.
So what is the communist science?
Well, it's whatever Marx said and wrote and Lenin and so on. So all these subjects are no longer taught in Russian theater schools or any other schools for that matter.
But you know them.
But there was such a, well, it would be a huge exaggeration. I mean, nobody really held us kind of responsible to knowing this, but it was so-called scientific communism. Can you imagine?
No.
There is such thing as scientific communism.
Yes.
So that's what it was in the history of the Communist Party and, you know, things that.
But these are required subjects.
The required subjects until after the time of perestroika, obviously, you know, and I was, you know, in school.
You were before that.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So you, at 19, with this huge block of experience behind you, already have written and acted and directed, really, essentially, most of your life, right? You go to school and you... Now, did you think you had to unlearn stuff? I mean, were you stubborn or were you open? Was it easy for you? Do you know what I mean?
I was open. I think that I wasn't a very good student because certain things came easy to me. And I think a lot of things I did just to satisfy the requirement. Unfortunately, this student mentality is not uncommon. And now that I work with students a lot, you know, of course I recognize it.
Yeah.
You know, and I do realize that there's a lot of things that I thought I understood and I didn't really. And I think that this is something that's, again, very common.
That was that's actually the question I was asking. Mm-hmm. And I do think it's very common. I think it's especially common, well, maybe this is an exaggeration or maybe this is a myth. But in order to be an actor, you really do have to believe that you have something to offer, that you know something, right? You can't get up there, you know.
You better have the sense of purpose behind this. Why you are doing it, what it is that you are either trying to contribute, or at least what it is that you cannot help but express. Cannot help but say
to the audience. Yes. So maybe this isn't true, but it seems to me, just talking to you, that that pretty much all of the people who do this will come to learning with a kind of sense, I already know this. Is that wrong?
In contemporary situation, yes, because especially if we are talking about graduate school, usually people come to the graduate acting training program like ours with some undergraduate background.
Yes.
And it usually is in theater and in acting. But if you really look at how popular the art of acting is nowadays, and we have programs like the Actor Studio or some other programs where actors constantly talk about their art.
Right.
Think that even when you come to the undergraduate program, you already have formed certain ideas. You heard something at least about method. You heard some actors interviewed. They told you exactly how
they did it.
And so you already come with certain idea. Probably, maybe you were taking theater classes in high school.
Right.
Lots of high schools have theater and acting classes nowadays.
Yes.
So really, I don't think that we are coming as a clean slate, which used to be the case with the actors of the old times, before Stanislavski, before the schools of acting, where actors really came as a clean slate and they were immediately thrown into practice, and they failed and failed and failed until they succeeded, unless they had this extraordinary gift. Exactly. So that is where I think we are at certain disadvantage, because depending, of course, on what it is that you heard, on what it is that you've been exposed to, once you enter, let's say, a conservatory or even undergraduate program that has very particular set of beliefs, you may have to unlearn. You may already have to actually kind of be prepared for a certain turnaround instead of just absorbing what you are given.
Yes, and I imagine that's difficult to do. Maybe this isn't true, but I imagine that is difficult
for actors. Unlearning is much more difficult than learning.
Well, just as a general rule it is, but I would think for actors it's even more difficult. Because it's their very self. It's not something, you know, it's not something they're writing on a pad. Or
yes, it is. It's their body, their nerves,
yes,
their imagination, their feelings. It's them.
Yeah, that's right. And then and people are observing it.
Yes.
So they're you know. So imagine it's quite difficult if you've already decided this is right for me, this is how I should do it, and then to have to undo
and
that.
I'm not even talking about how accessible all kinds of movies and TV programs are today. So these young people, they have seen movies from the 30s, from the 40s, contemporary movies,
yes.
Soap operas,
yes, right?
Right. It's TV shows and so on, and every time it's some kind of a very different style of acting.
Yes.
A very different way of kind of living on stage or living on the screen, right?
Yes.
Or just performing. So I think already this influence is there. They're copying a favorite actor, for example,
yes.
and their style and so on.
Yes.
And so there's a lot there already, which I suppose usually is not hugely helpful.
No, I'm sure that's correct. I'm sure that's correct. Okay, so now we're a little ahead of where I want to follow this line, but I want to go back. So at 19, was that true of you?
Yes, definitely, definitely, because I was very much enamored with certain style of acting and certain actors who probably would be called character actors.
Uh-huh.
And the art of physical characterization, external characterization, actually is really disappearing from contemporary theater to a certain degree.
Uh-huh.
Actors are much more likely to be more or less remaining themselves physically and being cast for their types rather than for their ability to be a chameleon,
something.
To become something.
Yes.
So we go to see a star because that star is predictable, because that star is mostly doing what they're doing, and that's what we kind of love about that star. In terms of transformation, well, this is usually kind of left to a makeup artist or something. Or sometimes we don't even ask for transformation. And I think that this style of acting was probably something that I really loved, because I loved these chameleons that I saw. But it's a very particular style and also a very different process, ultimately, that probably is not kind of a good thing to have as your starting point.
You grow into it.
You grow into it.
But this is the story of your life. You are starting at the top everywhere.
Yeah.
So this is just more of that, right?
Probably.
So what did they do with you, with this pipsqueak who came in with this idea about character
acting?
Well,
I think that they brought us back to the truth, back to I am, so that you're not even playing any character. But, of course, that's also deceiving, because if you realize, understand it literally, and you decide that, so first I need to learn how to just be myself on stage.
Yes.
That's also not true, because, of course, whenever the circumstances of your character's life are different from your circumstances,
then you can't be yourself.
You can't be yourself.
Right.
You have to transform.
Right.
So this whole idea that this is really you is nothing but a pedagogical tactic. But if you really believe in it, I think you're also going to get stuck with the idea that, I actually don't need to transform.
Yes.
Right? But transformation happens from day one. Without transformation, without the work of imagination, where you suddenly find yourself in a different situation and therefore certain different aspects of you come out,
yes.
aspects that maybe don't usually come out in everyday life. Without that idea, you also don't have a very clear vision of the process, because the process is you've got to become different, even though you also cannot become entirely different so that you lose yourself in it. So you have to remain yourself while becoming different, and that's
Ooh.
The contradiction number one, which is very difficult for actors to really understand.
Yes.
Finally, if you don't become different, then you will never be able to experience what the character experiences ultimately. Without transformation, you will not have access to your artistic emotions.
And it won't work. It won't be real. We won't believe it.
No.
Right.
So transformation and experience, emotional experience, go together, actually.
Okay, so that's what they tried to help you learn, or did help you learn, or focused on for you?
I think that probably the approach to acting, considering that we were really training as directors, was a little bit of a shortcut approach. And we were trained, and we even had, you know, full-blown production that we performed as actors at the end of our training. But I think that we were always looked upon, they kind of cut us a slack, so to speak.
Hmm.
They didn't use the same measures with us as they used with those who were on the acting track. We were supposed to be training as directors.
Yes.
And as long as we are passable actors, I think they were absolutely satisfied.
Okay,
you know,
I got
the standards were different.
I see. So you skipped a step.
Yes, and then I was really discovering myself as an actor later in my career after I have graduated.
As a director. Okay, so then what happened? So
and
now you're graduating as a director younger than anybody, right?
Yes, by that time I already had an amateur theater company that I organized and was running for a while.
I see.
I was doing it parallel to my training. And then finally this theater company, after I graduated, became my first priority, and the company developed into a professional company. It was one of the first private theater companies in Russia after Perestroika. Because before Perestroika, you couldn't start anything.
No matter what it is, whether it's a
grocery shop or theater company, nothing.
Right.
So because of the shifts in the policy, we were actually able to, you know, incorporate.
Perfect timing for you.
It was a
standing on the edge with this thing ready to go the minute, right?
Yeah. I worked with this company for about 8 years. I had a co-director, and he was directing, I was directing, I was acting, he acted occasionally, but he also took care of all the management, which right now I understand that I should really be bowing before him for having taken that load off of my shoulders. Ultimately, we traveled all over Russia, or what was Soviet Union at that time. We traveled extensively, we performed in Moscow. And we started an exchange program with two theater companies from the United States by the early 90s. And it's basically at that point that I came on an exchange, on a cultural exchange program, I came to the United States.
When was that?
That was 91. My aunt actually lived in Washington, D.C. She was a friend with a university professor through her husband. And this university professor working at the University of Maryland, he knew these actors who were very much interested in Russian theatrical tradition because part of their training was supposed to be Stanislavski's based. So they wanted to learn more.
Yeah.
And when this university professor, who was a professor of sociology, his name was John Robinson, he was a Russian sociologist, so he came to Russia frequently. He got to see our productions, he liked them, and he said, you really need to connect with my theater friends in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started simply going and visiting each other. Again, this was Perestroika time.
Yes, yes, yes.
So it became possible. The Iron Curtain was lifted.
Yes.
Something like this would have been entirely impossible.
Yeah.
Let's say in the early 80s, it would have been impossible. Even in the mid-80s, it was problematic. But by late 80s, early 90s, it became possible. So what happened then, it was kind of, we come and see you, you come and see us. And then I said, how long are we going to be going and seeing each other? Let's produce something together. So I really started trouble. And we did produce two productions, one classical Russian farce, another classical American farce. We rehearsed it in Moscow and showed it in Moscow. And then we rehearsed
both of them.
We rehearsed them it further in L.A., and we showed them in L.A.
Did you do the Russian play in Russian?
Russian actors in Russian, American actors in English. It was a bilingual production.
Wow.
Which was another very kind of bold step.
Yeah, no kidding.
So that's how we kind of stirred trouble and brought this collaboration further than just cultural exchange.
Yes, because
cultural exchange is usually just mutual visits.
Right, and hello, goodbye.
Hello, goodbye.
Right.
So that was a huge thing that we did. Actually.
So then, I mean, somehow you wound up here.
Yes, I mean, it happened for two reasons, and one reason, which is very important reason, is my wife.
Mm-hmm.
I met my wife on my first trip to D.C. She was in the sociology class led by that very professor of sociology, Jan Robinson, that I told you about. And she came to class late that day. She was considering skipping class, but then said, okay, these two Russian actors are going to be our guest speakers. So that's curious. So she at the last moment she decided to make the class, and she came in late, and the only free seat was smack in the first row. So needless to say, she attracted attention, and I approached her after the class. And at that point, I think my English was still pretty bad. I was almost kind of approaching her through my interpreter.
So you went up to this woman and you couldn't really talk to?
I couldn't really talk to her the way that I kind of as freely as I wanted to. And then gradually we went to the theater together, and we met on other occasions. And that was still the trip where I was just enjoying, you know, watching theater and sightseeing and so on. And then on the last night in D.C., I asked her if she would come to Moscow, and she said that she would, and she actually did, which was her first trip away from home, I think, in any direction.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
So and she certainly didn't speak any Russian.
And she didn't speak any Russian, so she was there really at my mercy. So that was very brave of her to do it. So, and kind of the rest is history.
It's history, exactly right. Well, and then when you two realized, whatever, that you wanted to be together, I guess there was no chance she was going to go live in Moscow.
Well, you guessed that right. I was inviting her and asking her that she, you know, that she would consider. But yes, my wife Lisa, she said no. She wasn't interested in living in Russia. And at the same time, it was interesting because my career in the States was kind of developing, because it was a very strange period in Russia where audience stopped going to the theater. And you probably know Russian theatrical culture and how important theater is in Russian cultural tradition. But it was very difficult period of the early 90s where there were such great hardships and people were so depressed. Theaters also weren't doing exactly what they should have been doing, but they were staging all of this depressing...
I was going to say they weren't doing comedy.
...about how tough your life is.
See, in America, in the Depression, we knew better, and we had all those wonderful comedies, right?
Yes. Oh, yes. But I understand why it happened, you see, because there are so many topics that were forbidden. That when suddenly it was allowed to talk about contemporary problems and hardships and social ills, right?
They wanted to do it.
And audiences had so much of it kind of in their own front yard.
Right, exactly.
That they just refused to go. So it all fortunately reversed, because theaters understood that they need to do classics.
Right.
And audiences immediately came back as long as, you know, as soon as theaters started doing classics. And by that time, however, I was already actually teaching at the Catholic University of America in D.C. at the drama department. I was first a resident director at the Chamber Theater, which was a D.C. company. And then I was, you know, doing lots of classes also in D.C., training actors. And actually, in 1998, I started my own theater company in Washington, D.C.
Wow.
So it kind of so happened that I was really able, obviously,
with the support
of my family, my wife, I was able to make a life here as a theater professional, which I must say is very rare.
No kidding.
Let's face it, most of the people who immigrate do not end up working in the field that they trained in.
Not only most of the people who emigrate, most of the people who decide they want to be in theater in the United States don't wind up working in their chosen career.
Unfortunately, is also.
Oh, my God, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I think it speaks probably to your talent, your skill, and your perseverance.
Simply because of what we talked about earlier. The fact that I am able to do so many things in the theatrical field.
Yes.
Because maybe if I could only do one thing,
yes,
I would not have made it.
Yes.
But because I can teach and I can act and I can direct, you know, and now I write about theater, maybe this is what's kind of helping me to stick to theater and not to have to do
You can have things. That if you like. I think it's probably talent, skill, and perseverance myself.
All right, but I was learned to always take credit, so I'll take credit.
Yes, yes. And to go back, I really believe that early experience of you can do it, you should do it, we want you to do it, we like it that you do it, that never leaves you. That becomes a part of how you feel about yourself. And you present that wherever you go. You present, oh, you should want me. You're going to want me, you know. And I think that that's...
I think that this is what was driving me for quite a while. I mean, every artist hits a certain crisis point. And I think that probably I also at some point while in D.C. hit that crisis point where I was actually beginning to doubt. I don't know if it was I was doubting myself or was I doubting that I can continue developing and grow in that particular environment. But you are right. I think for quite a long time I was driven by the license kind of and
that's,
the support.
That's exactly right. That is exactly the kind of word I was looking for.
Yeah.
So, how did you wind up in Sarasota, Florida?
Well, I was... It's the magic number 8 because I was... my theater company in Moscow existed for 8 years, and my DC theater company, which was very successful and won lots of Helen Hayes awards and nominations and was embraced by the community, by the kind of theater-going audience and also by the press, also existed for 8 years. This is where I have to go back to the time in Moscow where I was running a theater company as co-artistic director, but I didn't have to lift my finger.
Yes, because you had a manager.
To fundraise.
Yes.
Or to even worry about, you know, how we're going to get paid at the end of the month.
Yeah.
And not to mention all of the administrative work and so on. So that is something that I certainly got a full taste of in D.C. because I was producing artistic director, so not only was I, you know, directing and acting in some of the productions and, you know, in charge of the repertoire and casting, I was also in charge of the entire administrative operation and fundraising.
Oy.
Which is absolutely oy. So, again, the people who know how to do it and people who have talent to do it and people who enjoy doing it earned my respect.
God bless them.
God bless them. And God bless the people who give to the arts. But let's face it, it's not easy.
No.
Especially when you are at the same time running artistic kind of operations. So, or trying to continue developing as an artist. So 8 years was kind of enough.
Right.
And I said that I think that by now the managing part of it is really beginning to affect, is really beginning to affect how I develop as an artist. I also missed teaching because I was teaching at the Catholic University of America for quite a while, but eventually the company took priority.
Yeah.
I was teaching there for 2 years as a full-time professor, and then I continued teaching beyond that, actually, doing very different classes for a while. But I was missing a formal training because our training at the theater was actually all dedicated to productions. We tried to do formal training, but then a deadline would come and we'd start training actors specifically
for the part.
For the demands of this production.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Be it the part or be it particular, you know, technique that they had to do it, because a lot of this theater was movement oriented. There was a lot of movement, dance, singing, pantomime. So it was really a theater of synthesis where drama coexisted with the arts. So at that point, I felt that I would like to do teaching full-time again. And I would like to continue doing theater projects in my spare time, which I do.
Right.
But I really wanted to get back to teaching full-time.
And you wanted to stop fundraising.
And I wanted to stop fundraising badly, yes.
Yeah.
And I applied for this position, and I was so fortunate that the opening came.
What is this position?
It's a first-year acting professor, acting teacher. So I teach actors in their first year at the conservatory, and I direct in the second year. I direct one of the productions in the second year.
Well, let's talk about that now. So it's the production of Candida, which is currently running at the Cook Theater. So why did you choose it?
Because I wanted to do Shaw with the students.
Can you tell me what it was about Shaw you thought would be beneficial to the students?
I think a combination of very precise demands that come from a playwright. It's all in the play. He is incredibly prescriptive and incredibly precise in terms of how he wants his plays done. His stage directions are so thorough. They run pages sometimes.
Really?
Yes, he describes every character in detail, what they're wearing, what their characterization is. He describes all the stage directions, where you cross where you do
my
what.
My goodness!
Absolutely.
So this is necessary for people who may run into this kind of director or this kind of playwright. Is that what you mean?
I think so. Plus, obviously, his structure of language is very complex and at the same time very revealing in terms of the kind of style that he wants to be there. Because you can say this is life, you can say it's a nonstop debate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was one of the first playwrights, if not the first playwright, although he attributed all of that pioneering accomplishments to Ibsen for some reason, because he was so fond of Ibsen. But I think he also contributed some of his own accomplishments to Ibsen because he was so fond of him. And so he said Ibsen was the first to bring debate into theater. Of course, it was Shaw who was the first really to bring debate into theater. So be it, you know, this very particular kind of I would say acrobatics of thought and acrobatics of language, because they're incredibly vocal and incredibly... They're talking nonstop, and they're very good speakers, too.
Mm-hmm.
They're not at a loss of words. In the stressful situations where contemporary people grow numb, so to speak, you know, Shaw people only become even more eloquent. So you see all of these contemporary plays where people cannot put two words together and
right,
the language disintegrates,
right.
Where, you know, in Shaw situations the language only grows more elaborate when disaster strikes, so to speak. So all of it in conjunction with this coolness and even coldness that is usually attributed to Shaw, and at the same time, inner passion that lives within these characters. I mean, they're passionate about their ideas, they're also passionate about their beliefs and about their ideals and about their relationships.
About each other.
Exactly. So how do you really combine it? I thought it was a wonderful challenge for the students. And the final thing is that, you know, he says it's a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the moment you say mystery, people think murder mystery. Mystery in the sense kind of religious presence, so to speak, the presence of certain religious ideas, the presence of certain kind of higher powers that these people believe in, and these people kind of yield to in a way, because they all live in the mundane and they also live in the divine, so to speak. So that's the mystery.
Wait a minute. There is also the mystery of who's going to wind up with whom.
Yes, definitely. And there is a secret that the poet alone knows at the end of the play, which is one of his famous stage directions. But in the theatrical vocabulary, mystery means actually, you know, religious, religious, yeah.
The unknown.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. So what it means is that he wanted this play to be dealing with religion in a certain way. Obviously, the main character being the priest, it's kind of guaranteed.
Mm-hmm.
And the poet opposing his ideas. But at the same time, it's a comedy. So how do you actually put together mystery and comedy? What is the combination of it? Is one going to disappear at the expense of the other? So I thought those were wonderful challenges, especially in terms of how do you actually make these very precise directions your own? How do you make this very precise characterization your own? And how at the end of the day you find improvisational freedom, spontaneity, and your own creativity that is forever changing?
Within this structure.
Yes.
It's fascinating. And the ability to make debate seem human. It seems to me that's a major challenge. Okay, so I'm curious, what does the director do with a play where everything is already spelled out?
The director has a lot to do, because first of all, you have to know how to inspire the actors to bring their own creativity to this. How to establish organic approach where these roles are developing organically rather than, you know, there's always a temptation with an actor to deliver day one. And the moment they start delivering day one, they're delivering what Stanislavski used to call cliches or stereotype patterns. They're delivering this very fast kind of shortcut to the role, you know, and they're delivering something that is incredibly limiting and really doesn't have them in it, because they're delivering this empty characterization. For an actor to actually resist that temptation usually takes a director who is very particular and very patient and is actually creating the kind of conditions where the role can evolve, rather than creating the kind of conditions where day one, I'm sitting there expecting the opening night result.
Yes, yes, yes. Wow. Wow. And I imagine that it's even more tempting for an actor to deliver the cliche or, you know, when the directions have been
so precise,
right, yeah. Difficult for them to find the way to get to themselves within that structure. So the director not only needs to have patience, it seems to me, but needs to know the actors.
Needs to know the actors and needs to have very particular techniques that would actually allow actors to begin working immediately from their inner impulse, rather than from the kind of outside form that they very well perceive and envision from Shaw, and trying to basically illustrate it or imitate it. And that is something that the director has to be very mindful of. Plus, of course, no matter how much you prescribe, it is impossible to deliver, for example, the set that is exactly what Shaw might have wanted. So, and the set being even slightly different from his suggestions is going to immediately affect the blockings. So needless to say, there's still a lot of creativity that the director has to bring in there. But you know what? The more I direct, the more I understand that with the director, it is not so much, the question is not so much what to say to the actor, but what not to say to the actor. And to know how to stay out of the actor's way, and most importantly, help the actor to stay out of their own way.
Yes. We're talking about judgment here. I mean, self-criticism, judgment.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Looking back at every word and every movement that they're doing, or examining it even before they gave themselves the freedom to do anything.
Yes.
And refusing and rejecting certain things before they ever tried them out. It's very interesting because, of course, the key to all of the Shaw's plays lies in his prefaces. And, again, he has been ridiculed because some of his prefaces to the plays are longer than the plays themselves. He's got a couple of short plays where the preface is longer than the text of the play. So, but in this particular case, he very carefully gives us the clue in terms of what the meaning of the play is. He talks about his inspirations behind this play. He talks about trips to Italy.
Could you tell something about the inspirations?
Pre-Raphaelites, the Italian, you know, the Italian art of the Middle Ages, and as he says, its destruction by Renaissance.
Oh.
So in other words, Renaissance being a revolution in art and a revolution in thought, so to speak, being an inspiration behind Candida, because again, he talks about revolution. Well, Shaw was a socialist after all. Eugene is not just a poet, he is a revolutionary for whom Candida is his god, because she is the new woman who is going to ultimately liberate humanity. Interestingly enough, she is equally her husband's god. Her husband, socialist priest, believes in Candida more than he believes in Christ and more than he believes in socialism, because Candida for him symbolizes everything that he believes in.
Candida comes originally from the low background. Her father obviously was born in poverty. That is why he speaks in Cockney accent, you know, or rather dialect. And clearly is an uneducated man who made his fortune as he went. So Candida knew poverty. Morel himself didn't. So you're beginning to wonder, is Morel really striving for justice, struggling for justice, or is he struggling for Candida? Because, you know, she's his inspiration behind it. Candida also has this independent spirit. She defies the conventional morals. She says, do you think that this is morals that prevent me from falling in love with Eugene, or basically showing him what love truly is? It's not morals, it's simply because I happen to love you, my dear husband. You see, it has nothing to do. So she is ready, like Nora, ultimately, to defy these conventional morals. And Shaw says that they're outdated. And for Eugene, she is that new humanity, new liberated humanity that he wants to save from Morel's clutches. Because Morel's Christian socialism obviously is, for Eugene, something that long outlived itself, and he is already foreseeing some new horizons. Yeah. So that key to this understanding lies, I think, more in the preface than really in the play, because in the play you can easily overlook it. But he also was a great artist. That's why he was able to nevertheless create characters who actually were, you know, live people. Because, of course, these people speak the kind of language that maybe somebody like Shaw can speak because of its eloquence. But at the same time, they're all different. They all have their own speech characterizations. They all have their own biographies. So these are realistic plays, despite the fact that, of course, they're stylized. They're also realistic plays because these people are individual.
Yes.
They are not types, even.
I'm curious now, and I haven't thought about this before either, but his assistant, whose name I don't remember,
Lexi Mill.
Yes. Mm-hmm. What is his role in this?
He is a blind follower of Morel,
yes.
Ultimately.
Oh, he represents that blind following.
Blind following, rather than Candida, who is an independent thinker, so to speak.
Or Eugene.
Or Eugene, who just challenges all of these ideas. Yes. Lexi is an interesting thing, because the way that ultimately our actor, Jefferson MacDonald, performed him is he starts as a blind follower, but at the end, when Morel is sending him out into the night and into the cold to look after the secretary who is drunk, I mean, he gives that final look to Morel as if saying, oh, I just worked for you all day, I did all of your rounds while you were, you know, at home meeting your wife, I just went to that meeting, I prevented a disaster, and now you're sending me out, you know, into the cold. So there's a very interesting kind of flash of reproach.
The emergence of his independence.
His independence,
yes.
Exactly.
And the secretary who got drunk, maybe that is hers as well.
Oh, absolutely. It's a very interesting situation. So it's something, these touches, of course, are so subtle. And that's Shaw. You know, that's Shaw with his sarcasm and irony, who immediately is going to juxtapose these things.
And at the same time, that all of this is going on, all of these deeply philosophical questions are going on.
Mm-hmm.
The play is fun.
The play is a great fun. And that was really one of the jobs that I felt we must accomplish. And so now some people say, maybe there is more fun in it than there is heart in it. And it's a very interesting question because, of course, Shaw has always been accused of being heartless. In terms of, do they have a heart and what is that heart? But one thing that they do have, they have passions.
Yes, they do. All of, well, I don't know about Lexi, but everybody else is extremely passionate.
Lexi's passion wakes up when Morel is about to turn down engagement.
That's right.
And
that's
when
right.
the president of the Agnostic League is about to replace
right.
him as a speaker,
right.
You know, the fellow who is going to undo everything that, of course, Morel has done because he speaks, he favors the divorce of socialism from Christianity, that Agnostic leader.
Yes, but and that passion, of course, is the passion of a follower. Don't disillusion me.
So their passion, and I think that's exactly what Shaw said. He said that in the future, people will discover that there is passion in my plays. Actually, he never said warmth. He never said heart. He never said intimacy. He said passion.
Mm.
Because even when husband and wife, remain alone and become very intimate, where he's sitting in a chair and she's kneeling next to him, what are they talking about? They're talking about the congregation. They're
yes.
talking about, another man. I mean, it's very interesting that there is some coldness in it, and nevertheless, there is a tremendous passion. But you're not going to find the kind of coziness, warmth, and sentimentality in Shaw that sometimes is rightly or unrightly found in, let's say, Chekhov or even some other.
But again, it's a challenge for the actor, isn't it, to do passion without warmth.
So this is where the comedy comes in as a challenge, because, of course, there are profound ideas, there are these characters, there are these relationships. But you know what comedy means? Comedy ultimately means that there is not a lot of heart, because, yes, there is romantic comedy, but this is not romantic comedy.
No, but it's cerebral, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay, so you want to rush right out and see this play. Yeah. Okay, you are someone who has an entire life dedicated to the theater in various ways. So if you would think for a moment about what it's like to live a life that's completely dedicated to an art.
I consider myself lucky to be able to do what I am doing, and especially to do it having come to a different country, having come to the United States. So I think that there are probably a lot of artists who have to suffer for their art much more than I do. I think we all have to suffer for it, because it's all consuming. Very often family suffers because of this, and people who are married to artists or live with artists, they have to support very often in the way that they probably wouldn't have to support in such a radical way if they were married to saner people, right? To people who are a bit more normal and wouldn't. The problem is that the creative process, of course, is a 24-hour process, and that's where
it's an obsession.
It's an obsession, and that's, you cannot really stop it. You can't. I mean, you can try, of course, but usually it's kind of counterproductive. And great art happens when, of course, you dedicate all of you to it. So I think that from that standpoint, of course, it is difficult. Maybe more difficult even for those around us than for us. So again, I consider myself lucky and fortunate to be able to, as you said, dedicate my life to the arts and specifically to theater.
Well, that's great. This has been a wonderful, wonderful interview. Thank you so much,
Andre. Thank you, brother.
So you can see by listening to Andre that he is someone who discovered so early what he was, who he was, what he was drawn to. And as I point out in the interview, he had what I believe to be the single most important thing one can have, and that is the wonderful support of his family. The indulgence that it was fine for him to be who he was. In fact, they liked it, they encouraged it, they enjoyed it, they, as I said, indulged it. And the end result is we have a man who can and does give his life to this art and spends his life giving away now what he spent it learning. And if you rush out and see Candida, you will see an example of how he gives it away. And if what he and I have said about the play hasn't made you want to run right out and get tickets, then I think Sharon Leslie's review of this production, which I'm going to play right now, ought to. In the play Candida by George Bernard Shaw, the young poet Eugene Marchbanks is madly and improbably in love with the beautiful, older, and happily married Candida, thus creating an absurd love triangle at the center of this charming comedy. The Oslo Acting Conservatory is tackling the world of Victorian England with vim and vigor. The gorgeously costumed production on a handsome set moves along at a crisp tempo, engaging the audience. Director Andrei Malayev-Babel never allows the sometimes overblown social commentary that we have come to expect in a Shaw to get bombastic or boring. Actually, quite a feat. When the play opens, Reverend James Morrell is planning out his speaking engagements while awaiting the return of his wife, Candida. He professes his contentment and happiness at being married and highly recommends that blissful state. Of course, we know this cannot last for long, as into the scene arrives the poet Marchbanks to jumble up the proceedings. Marchbanks has accompanied Candida on her journey and wants to finagle a place to stay for the night, just to be close to her. With a few twists and turns of plot, the men demand Candida choose between them. As a matter of womanly revenge for being put into such an absurd predicament, Candida forces each man to state his best case of why she should pick him. We, the audience, and Marchbanks are treated to why Candida loves her husband, whom she professes to be the weaker of the two. And with that revelation, Marchbanks leaves the loving couple happy in the knowledge that Candida is happy. All the actors on stage are in their second of 3 years of study for their master's degree in the Florida State University program. I was happy to see the colorblind casting in the choices of who played what roles. And since all were of similar ages, the variety of age ranges that Shaw built into the piece could not be fully realized, but that was also fine with me. I enjoyed the production. As Candida, Amanda Lynn Mullen imbued her character with a playful quality and had just the right tone of firmness when needed as one who truly runs the household. Most amusing yet bold choices were made by Brian Williamson's portrayal of the poet. His Marchbanks is more than an effete. He springs around the stage with a body language that clearly has a touch of epilepsy. With that choice, his character has a degree of suffering and physical frailness that goes beyond the artistic and reaches out to all for a compassionate sympathy. Yet, Marchbanks is no innocent. He has learned how to manipulate people. The production came alive when Williamson's Marchbanks walked through the door. He was marvelous in reaching the highs and lows of a teenager infatuated with love. The conservatory production is visually delightful and amusing. I am a fan of well-done George Bernard Shaw, so I had a great time. That's all I have time for. So, as always, I need to thank Josh Hackney, without whom, as I say every week, nothing could get done. And again, as always, I hope you got something you can use from this show, something that will bring you back, because I will be here next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be, too.
You see, I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray, oh, you see my face and figure, I've both seen better days, well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight, no, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot, my time has come and gone, oh, I won't.
won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseen.